The girl blinked at me several times. You know me? You are a sometimes associate of Harry Dresden, I said. Given his proclivities about those he considers to be held under his aegis, it is sensible to identify as many of them as possible, for the sake of my insurance rates, if nothing else. Guard? Justine, no last name you'll admit to, Guard said calmly. Currently employed as Lara Wraith's secretary and personal aide. You are the sometimes lover of Thomas Wraith, a frequent ally of Dresden's. I spread my hands slightly. I assume the J notation at the bottom of Ms. Wraith's typed correspondence refers to you. Yes, Justine said. She had regained her composure quickly, not something I would have expected of the servitor of a vampire of the White Court. Many of the people, I suppose, I'd seen there had made Lotus Eaters look self-motivated.
Yes, exactly.
I nodded. Given your patron, one is curious as to why you have come to me seeking protection.
Time, sir, she replied quietly. I lacked any other alternative.
Someone screamed at the front of the building. My headquarters shifts position irregularly as I acquire new buildings. Much of my considerable wealth is invested in real estate. I own more of the town than any other single investor. In Chicago, there is always money to be had by purchasing and renovating aging buildings. I do much of my day-to-day work out of one of my most recent renovation projects, once they have been modified to be suitable places to welcome guests. Then renovation of the building begins, and the place is generally crowded with contractors who've proven their ability to see and hear nothing. Guard's head snapped up. She shook it as if to rid herself of a buzzing fly and said, "A presence. A strong one." Her blue eyes snapped to Justine. "Who?" The young woman shuddered and wrapped the towel more tightly about herself.
"Mag. A cantrev lord of the Fomor."
Guard spat something in a Scandinavian tongue that was probably a curse. "Precy, please," I said. "The Fomor are an ancient folk," she said. "Water dwellers, cousins of the Jotuns. Extremely formidable. Sorcerers, shape-changers, seers." "And signatories," I noted. "Yes," she said. She crossed to the other side of the room, opened a closet, and withdrew an athletic bag. She produced a simple, rather crude-looking broadsword from it and tossed it toward Hendrix. The big man caught it by the handle and took his gun into his left hand. Guard took a broad-bladed axe out of the bag and shouldered the weapon. "But rarely involved in mortal affairs." "Ms. Wraith sent me to the Fomor King with documents," Justine said, her voice coming out quietly and rapidly. Her shivering had increased. "Mag made me his prisoner. I escaped with the child. There wasn't time to reach one of my lady's strongholds. I came to you, sir. I beg your protection as a favor to Ms. Wraith." "I don't grant favors," I said calmly. Mag entered in the manner so many of these self-absorbed supernatural cretins seem to adore. He blasted the door into a cloud of flying splinters with what I presumed was magic. "For God's sake." At least the vampires would call for an appointment. The blast amounted to little debris. After a few visits from Dresden and his ilk, I had invested in cheap, light doors at dramatic, as opposed to tactical, entry points. The Fomor was a pale, repellent humanoid. 7 feet tall, give or take, and distinctly frog-like in appearance. He had a bloated belly, legs several inches too long to be proportionately human, and huge feet and hands. He wore a tunic of something that resembled seaweed beneath a long, flapping blue robe, covered in the most intricate embroidery I had ever seen. A coronet of coral was bound about his head. His right hand was extended dramatically. He carried a twisted length of wood in his left. His eyes bulged, jaundice yellow around septic green, and his teeth were rotted and filthy. "You cannot run from me," he said. His wide mouth made the words seem somehow slurred. "You are mine." Justine looked up at me, evidently too frightened to turn her head, her eyes wide with fear. A sharper contrast would have been hard to manage.
Sir, please.
I touched a button on the undersurface of my desk, a motion of less than 2 inches, and then made a steeple of my hands again as I eyed Mag and said, "Excuse me, sir. This is a private office." Mag surged forward half a step, his eyes focused on the girl.
"Hold your tongue, mortal, if you would keep it."
I narrowed my eyes.
"Is it so much to ask for civility?"
"Justine," I said calmly, "if you would stand aside, please." Justine quickly, silently, moved out from between us. I focused on Mag and said, "They are under my protection." Mag gave me a contemptuous look and raised the staff. Darkness lashed at me, as if he had simply reached into the floorboards and cracks in the wall and drawn it into a sizzling sphere the size of a bowling ball. It flickered away to nothingness about a foot in front of my steepled hands. I lifted a finger, and Hendrik shot Mag in the back, repeatedly. The Fomor went down with a sound like a bubbling tea kettle, whipped onto his back as if the bullets had been a minor inconvenience, and raised the stick to point at Hendrik's. Guard's axe smashed it out of his grip, swooped back up to guard, and began to descend again. "Stop," I said. Guard's muscles froze just before she would have brought down the axe onto Mag's head. Mag had one hand uplifted, surrounded in a kind of negative haze, his long fingers crooked at odd angles, presumably some kind of mystic defense. "As a freeholding lord of the Unseelie Accords," I said, "it would be considered an act of war if I killed you out of hand, despite your militant intrusion into my territory." I narrowed my eyes. "However, your behavior gives me ample latitude to invoke the Defense of Property and Self Clause. I will leave the decision to you. Continue this asinine behavior, and I will kill you and offer a wereguild to your lord, King Korb, in accordance with the Conflict Resolution Guidelines of Section 2, Paragraph 4.
As I told you, my lawyers send me endless letters. I speak their language."
Mag seemed to take that in for a moment. He looked at me, then guard. His eyes narrowed. They tracked back to Hendrix, his head hardly moving, and he seemed to freeze when he saw the sword in Hendrix's hand. His eyes flicked to Justine and the child and burned for a moment, not with adoration or even simple lust. There was a pure and possessive hunger there, coupled with a need to destroy that which he desired. I have spent my life around hard men. I know that form of madness when I see it.
"So," Mag said. His eyes traveled back to me and were suddenly heavy-lidded and calculating. "You are the new mortal lord. We half believed that you must be imaginary, that no one could be as foolish as that."
"You are incorrect," I said. "Moreover, you can't have them. Get out." Mag stood up. The movement was slow, liquid. His limbs didn't seem to bend the proper way.
"Lord Marcone," he said, "this affair is no concern of yours. I only wish to take the slaves."
"You can't have them. Get out."
"I warn you," Mag said.
There was an ugly tone in his voice.
"If you make me return for her, for them, you will not enjoy what follows."
"I do not require enjoyment to thrive. Leave my domain." "I won't ask again." Hendrix shuffled his feet a little, setting his balance. Mag gathered himself up slowly. He extended his hand, and the twisted stick leapt from the floor and into his fingers.
He gave Guard a slow and well-practiced sneer and said, "Anon, mortal lordling. It is time you learned the truth of the world. It will please me to be your instructor."
Then he turned, slow and haughty, and walked out, his shoulders hunching in an odd, unsettling motion as he moved.
"Make sure he leaves," I said quietly. Guard and Hendricks followed Mag from the room. I turned my eyes to Justine and the child.
"Mag," I said, "is not the sort of man who is used to disappointment."
Justine looked after the vanished Fomor, and then back at me, confusion in her eyes.
"That was sorcery. How did you?"
I stood up from behind my desk and stepped out of the copper circle set into the floor around my chair. It was powered by the sorceress equivalent of a 9-volt battery, connected to the control on the underside of my desk.
"Basic magical defense," Guard said. It had seemed like nonsense to me.
It clearly was not. I took my gun from its holster and set it on my desk. Justine took note of my reply.
Of course, I wouldn't give the personal aid of the most dangerous woman in Chicago information about my magical defenses. There was something hard and not at all submissive in her eyes.
"Thank you, sir,
for what?" I said very calmly. "You understand, do you not, what you have done by asking for my help under the Accords?"
"Sir?"
"The Accords govern relations between supernatural powers," I said. "The signatories of the Accords and their named vassals are granted certain rights and obligations, such as offering a warning to a signatory who has trespassed upon another's territory unwittingly before killing him."
"I know, sir," Justine said.
"Then you should also know that you are most definitely not a signatory of the Accords. At best, you qualify in the category of servitors and chattel. At worst, you are considered to be a food animal."
She drew in a sharp breath, her eyes widening, not in any sense of outrage or offense, but in realization.
Good. She grasped the realities of the situation.
"In either case," I continued, "you are property. You have no rights in the current situation in the eyes of the Accords, and, more to the point, I have no right to withhold another's rightful property. Mag's behavior provided me with an excuse to kill him if he did not depart. He will not give me such an opening a second time."
Justine swallowed and stared at me for a moment. Then she glanced down at the child in her arms. The child clung harder to her and seemed to lean somewhat away from me.
One must admire such acute instincts.
"You have drawn me into a conflict that has nothing to do with me," I said quietly. "I suggest candor. Otherwise, I will have Mr. Hendricks and Ms. Guard show you to the door."
"You can't," she began, but her voice trailed off.
"I can," I said. "I am not a humanitarian. When I offer charity, it is for tax purposes." The room became silent. I was content with that. The child began to whimper quietly.
"I was delivering documents to the court of King Korb on behalf of my lady," Justine said. She stroked the child's hair absently. "It's in the sea. There's a gate there in Lake Michigan not far from here."
I lifted an eyebrow. "You swam?"
"I was under the protection of their courier going there," Justine said. "It's like walking in a bubble of air."
She hitched the child up a little higher on her hip.
"Mag saw me. He drove the courier away as I was leaving and took me to his home. There were many other prisoners there."
"Including the child," I guessed, though it probably didn't sound that way.
Justine nodded. "I arranged for several prisoners to flee Mag's home. I took the child when I left. I swam out."
"So you are, in effect, stolen property in possession of stolen property," I said. "Novel."
Guard and Hendricks came back into the office. I looked at Hendricks. "My people?"
"Tulane's got a broken arm," he said. "Standing in that asshole's way, he's on his way to the dock."
Thank you, Ms. Gard. Mag is off the property, she said. He didn't go far. He's summoning support now.
How much of a threat is he? I asked.
The question was legitimate. Gard and Hendricks had blindsided the inhuman while he was focused on Justine and the child and while he wasted his leading magical strike against my protective circle. A head-on confrontation against a prepared foe could be a totally different proposition. Gard tested the edge of her axe with her thumb and drew a smooth stone from her pocket. Mag is a Fomor sorcerer lord of the first rank. He's deadly and connected. The Fomor could crush you without a serious loss of resources. Confrontation would be unwise. The stone made a steely, slithery sound as it glided over the axe's blade.
There seems little profit to be had, then, I said. It's nothing personal, Justine, merely business. I am obliged to return stolen property to signatory members of the Accords.
Hendricks looked at me sharply.
He didn't say anything. He didn't have to. I already knew the tone of whatever he would say. Are there no prisons, perhaps, or no man is an island entire of itself? It tolls for thee. On and on.
Hendricks has no head for business.
Gard watched me, waiting.
Sir, Justine said, her tone measured and oddly formal. May I speak?
I nodded.
She isn't property, Justine said, and her voice was low and intense, her eyes direct. She was trapped in a den of living nightmares, and there was no one to come save her. She would have died there, and I am not letting anyone take her back to that hellhole. I will die first.
The young woman set her jaw.
She is not property, Mr. Marcone. She's a child.
I met Justine's eyes for a long moment. I glanced aside at Hendricks. He waited for my decision.
Gard watched me. As ever, Gard watched me.
I looked down at my hands, my fingertips resting together with my elbows propped on the desk. Business came first. Always. But I have rules. I looked up at Justine.
She's a child, I said quietly.
The air in the room snapped tight with tension. Ms. Gard, I said, please dismiss the contractors for the day at pay, then raise the defenses. She pocketed the whetstone and strode quickly out, her teeth showing a bounce in her step. Mr. Hendricks, please scramble our troubleshooters. They're to take positions across the street, suppressed weapons only. I don't need patrolmen stumbling around in this. Then ready the panic room. Hendricks nodded and got out his cell phone as he left. His huge, stubby fingers flew over its touchscreen as he sent the activation text message. Looking at him, one would not think him capable of such a thing. But that is Hendricks, generally. I looked at Justine as I rose and walked to my closet. You will go with the child into the panic room. It is, with the possible exception of Dresden's home, the most secure location in the city.
Thank you, she said quietly.
I took off my coat and hung it up in the closet. I took off my tie and slipped it over the same hanger. I put my cufflinks in my coat pocket, rolled up my sleeves, and skinned out of my gun's holster. Then I slipped on the armored vest made of heavy scales of composite materials joined to sleeves of quite old-fashioned mail. I put an old field jacket, olive drab, over the armor, belted it, holstered my sidearm at my side, opposite a combat knife, and took a military-grade assault shotgun, a weapon every bit as illegal as my pistol in the city of Chicago, from its rack. I am not doing it for you, young lady, I said, nor am I doing it for the child.
Then why are you doing it? She asked.
Because I have rules, I said.
She shook her head gently. But you're a criminal. Criminals don't have rules. They break them.
I stopped and looked at her. Justine blanched and slid a step farther away from me along the wall. The child made a soft, distressed sound. I beckoned curtly for her to follow me as I walked past her. It took her a moment to do so.
Honestly,
Someone in the service of a vampire ought to have a bit more fortitude. This panic room looked like every other one I've had built. Fluorescent lights, plain tile floor, plain drywall. Two double bunks occupied one end of the room. A business desk and several chairs took up the rest. A miniature kitchen nestled into one corner, opposite the miniature medical station in another. There was a door to a half-bath and a bank of security monitors on the wall between them. I flicked one switch that activated the entire bank, displaying a dozen views from hidden security cameras. I gestured for Justine to enter the room. She came in and immediately took a seat on the lower bunk of the nearest bed, still holding the child. "Mag can find her," Guard told me when we all rendezvoused outside the panic room. "Once he's inside the building and gets past the forward area, he'll be able to track her. He'll head straight for her." "Then we know which way he'll be moving," I said. "What did you find out about his support?" "They're creatures," Guard said. "Actual mortal beings, though like none you've seen before. The Fomor twist flesh to their liking and sell the results for favors and influence. It was probably the Fomor who created those cat things the Knights of the Blackened Denarius used." I twisted my mouth in displeasure at the name. "If they're mortal, we can kill them." "They'll die hard," Guard warned me. "What doesn't?" I looked up and down the hallway outside the panic room. "I think the primary defense plan will do." Guard nodded. She had attired herself in an armored vest not unlike my own over a long male shirt. Medieval looking, but then modern armorers haven't aimed their craft at stopping claws of late. Hendricks, standing watch at the end of the hall, had on an armored vest but was otherwise covered in modified motorcyclist's armor. He carried an assault shotgun like mine, several hand grenades, and that same broadsword. "Stay here," I said to Justine. "Watch the door. If anyone but one of us comes down the stairs, shut it." She nodded. I turned and started walking toward the stairway. I glanced at Guard. "What can we expect from Mag?" "Pain," Hendricks grunted, skeptically. "He's ancient, devious, and wicked," Guard clarified. "There is an effectively unlimited spectrum of ways in which he might do harm." I nodded. "Can you offer any specific knowledge?" "He won't be easy to get to," she said. "The Fomor practice entropy magic. They make the anti-technology effect Dresden puts off look like mild sunspot activity. Modern systems are going to experience problems near him." We started up the stairs. "How long before he arrives?" From upstairs, there was a crash of breaking plate glass. No alarm went off, but there was a buzzing, sizzling sound and a scream. Guard's outer defenses. Hendricks hit a button on his cell phone and then came with me as I rushed up the remaining stairs to the ground floor. The lights went out as we went, and Hendricks's phone sputtered out a few sparks. Battery-powered emergency lights flicked on an instant later. Only about half of them functioned, and most of those were behind us. Mag had waited for nightfall to begin his attack and then crippled our lights. Quite possibly he assumed that the darkness would give him an overwhelming advantage. The hubris of some members of the supernatural community is astonishing. The night vision scopes mounted on my weapon and Hendrix's had been custom-made based off designs dating back to World War II, before night vision devices had married themselves to the electronics revolution. They were heavy and far inferior to modern systems, but they would function in situations where electronic goggles would be rendered into useless junk. We raised the weapons to our shoulders, lined an eye up with the scopes, and kept moving. We reached the first defensive position, folded out the reinforced composite barriers mounted there, and knelt behind them. The ambient light from the city outside and the emergency lights below us was enough for the scopes to do their jobs. I could make out the outline of the hallway and the room beyond. Sounds of quiet movement came closer. My heart rate had gone up, but not alarmingly so. My hands were steady. My mouth felt dry, and my body's reaction to the prospect of mortal danger sent ripples of sensation up and down my spine. I embraced the fear and waited. The Fomor's creatures exploded into the hallway on a storm of roars. I couldn't make out many details. They seemed to have been put together on the chassis of a gorilla. Their heads were squashed, ugly-looking things with wide gaping mouths full of shark-like teeth. The sounds they made were deep, with a frenzied edge of madness, and they piled into the corridor in a wave of massive muscle. "Steady," I murmured. The creatures lurched as they moved, like cheap toys that had not been assembled properly, but they were fast for all of that. More and more of them flooded into the hallway, and their charge was gaining momentum. "Steady," I murmured. Hendricks grunted. There were no words in it, but he meant, "I know." The wave of Fomorian beings got close enough that I could see the patches of mold clumping their fur and tendrils and of mildew growing upon their exposed skin. "Fire," I said. Hendricks and I opened up. The new military AA-12 automatic shotguns are not the hunting weapons I first handled in my patriotically delusional youth. They are fully automatic weapons with large circular drums that rather resembled the old Tommy guns made iconic by my business predecessors in Chicago. One pulls the trigger and shell after shell slams through the weapon. A steel target hit by bursts from an AA-12 rapidly comes to resemble a screen door. And we had two of them. The slaughter was indescribable. It swept like a great broom down that hallway, tearing and shredding flesh, splattering blood on the walls and painting them most of the way to the ceiling. Behind me, guards stood ready with a heavy caliber big game rifle, calmly gunning down any creature that seemed to be reluctant to die before it could reach our defensive point. We piled the bodies so deep that the corpses formed a barrier to our weapons. "Hendricks," I said. The big man was already reaching for the grenades on his belt. He took one, pulled the pin, cooked it for a slow two count, and then flung it down the hall. We all crouched behind the barriers as the grenade went off with a deafening crunch of shockwave-driven air. Hendricks threw another one. He might disapprove of killing, but he did it thoroughly. When the ringing began to fade from my ears, I heard a sound like raindrops. It wasn't raining, of course. The gunman in the building across the street had opened fire with silenced weaponry. Bullets whispered in through the windows and hit the floors and walls of the headquarters with innocuous-sounding thumps. Evidently, Mag's servitors had been routed and were trying to flee. An object the size of Hendrix's fist appeared from nowhere and arced cleanly through the air. It landed on the floor precisely between the two sheltering panels, a lump of pink and gray coral. Guard hit me with a shoulder and drove me to the ground, even as she shouted, "Down!" The piece of coral didn't explode. There was a whispering sound, and hundreds of tiny holes appeared in the blood-stained walls and ceiling. Guard let out a pained grunt. My left calf jerked as something pierced it and burned as though the wound had been filled with salt. I checked Hendricks. One side of his face was covered in a sheet of blood. Small tears were visible in his leathers, and he was beginning to bleed through the holes. "Get him," I said to guard, rising as another coral spheroid rose into the air. Before it could get close enough to be a threat, I blew it to powder with my shotgun. And the next, while guard dropped her rifle, got a shoulder under one of Hendrix's and helped him to his feet as if he'd been her weight instead of 270 pounds of muscle. She started down the stairs. A fourth sphere came accompanied by mocking laughter, and when I pulled the trigger again, the weapon didn't function. Empty. I slapped the coral device out of the air with the shotgun's barrel and flung myself backwards, hoping to clear the level of the floor on the stairwell before the pseudo-grenade detonated. I did not quite make it. Several objects struck my chest and arms, and a hot blade slipped across my unscarred ear. But the armor turned the truly dangerous projectiles. I broke my arm, tumbling backward down the stairs. More laughter followed me down, but at least the Fomor wasn't spouting some kind of ridiculous monologue.
I did my best, came Mag's voice. I gave you a chance to return what was mine. But no, you couldn't keep yourself from interfering in my affairs, from stealing my property. And so now you will reap the consequences of your foolishness, little mortal.
There was more, but there is hardly a need to go into details. Given a choice between that egocentric drivel and a broken arm, I prefer the latter. It's considerably less excruciating. Guard hauled me to my feet by my coat with her spare hand. I got under the stunned Hendrix's other arm and helped them both down the rest of the stairs. Justine stood in the doorway of the safe room at the end of the hallway of flickering lights, her face white-lipped but calm. Guard helped me get Hendrix to the door of the room and turned around. Close the door. I may be able to discourage him out here. Your home office would be annoyed with me if I wasted your life on such a low percentage proposition, I said. We stick to the plan. The Valkyrie eyed me. Your arm is broken. I was aware, thank you, I said. Is there any reason the countermeasure shouldn't work? Mag was going on about something, coming down the steps one at a time, making a production out of every footfall. I ignored the ass. None that I know of, Guard admitted, which is not the same answer as no. Sir, Justine said. We planned for this, or something very like it. We don't split up now. End of discussion. Help me with Hendrix. Sir, Justine said. I looked up to see Mag standing on the landing, cloaked in random shadows, smiling. The emergency lights on the stairwell blew out with a melodramatic shower of dying sparks. Ah, I said. I reached inside the safe room door, found the purely mechanical pull cord wrapped unobtrusively around a nail head on the wall, and gave it a sharp jerk. It set off the anti-personnel mines built into the wall of the landing. There were four of them, which meant that a wash of fire and just under 3,000 round shot acquainted themselves with the immediate vicinity of the landing and with Mag. A cloud of flame and flying steel enveloped the Fomor, but at the last minute the swirling blackness around him rose like a living thing, forming a shield between Mag and the oncoming flood of destruction. The sound of the explosions was so loud that it demolished my hearing for a moment. It began to return to me as the cloud of smoke and dust on the landing started to clear. I could hear a fire alarm going off. Mag, smudged and blackened with residue but otherwise untouched, made an irritated gesture, and the fire alarm sparked and fizzled, but not before setting off the automatic sprinklers. Water began pouring down from spigots in the ceiling. Mag looked up at the water and then down at me, and his too wide smile widened even more.
Really? He asked. Water? Did you actually think water would be a barrier to the magic of a Fomor lord?
Running water was highly detrimental to mortal magic, or so Guard informed me, whether it was naturally occurring or not. The important element was quantity. Enough water would ground magic just as it could conduct electricity and short-circuit electronics. Evidently, Mag played by different rules. Mag made a point to continue down the stairs at exactly the same pace. He was somewhat hampered in that several of the stairs had been torn up rather badly in the explosion, but he made it to the hallway. Guard took up a position in the middle of the hallway, her axe held straight up beside her in both arms like a baseball player's bat. I helped Hendrix into the safe room and dumped him on a bunk, out of any line of fire from the hallway. Justine took one look at his face and hurried over to the medical station where she grabbed a first aid kit. She rushed back to Hendrix's side. She broke open the kit and started laying out the proper gear for getting a clear look at a bloody wound and stopping the bleeding. Her hands flew with precise speed. She'd had some form of training. From the opposite bunk, the child watched Justine with wide blue eyes. She was naked and had been crying.
The tears were still on her little cheeks. Even now, her lower lip had begun to tremble. But so far as anyone else knew, I was made of stone. I turned and crossed the room. I sat down at the desk, a copy of the one in my main office. I put my handgun squarely in front of me. The desk was positioned directly in line with the door to the panic room. From behind the desk, I could see the entire hallway clearly. Mag stepped forward and moved a hand as though throwing something. I saw nothing, but Guard raised her axe in a blocking movement, and there was a flash of light, and the image of a Norse rune, or something like it, was burned onto my retina. The outer edge of Guard's male sleeve on her right arm abruptly turned black and fell to dust, so that the sleeve split and dangled open. Guard took a grim step back as Mag narrowed his jaundiced eyes and lifted the crooked stick. Something that looked like the blend of a lightning bolt and an eel lashed through the air toward Guard, but she caught it on the broad blade of her axe, and there was another flash of light, another eye-searing rune. I heard her cry out, though, and saw that the edges of her fingernails had been burned black. Step by step, she fell back while Mag hammered at her with things that made no sense, many of which I could not even see. Each time, the rune magic of that axe defeated the attack, and each time it seemed to cost her something. A lightly singed face here, a long, shallow cut on her newly bared arm there, and the runes I saw were each in different places on the axe, being burned out one by one. Guard had a finite number of them. As Guard's heels touched the threshold of the safe room, Mag let out a howl and threw both hands out ahead of him. An unseen force lifted Guard from her feet and flung her violently across the room, over my desk and into the wall. She hit with bone-crushing force and slid down limply. I faced the inhuman sorcerer alone. Mag walked slowly and confidently into my safe room and stared at me across my desk. He was breathing heavily from exertion or excitement or both. He smiled slowly and waved his hand again. An unpleasant shimmer went through the air, and I glanced down to see rust forming on the exposed metal of my gun while cracking began to spread through the plastic grip.
"Go ahead, mortal," Mag said, drawing out the words. "Pick up the gun. Try it. The crafting of the weapon is fine, mortal, but you are not the masters of the world that you believe yourselves to be. Even today's cleverest smiths are no match for the magic of the Fomor."
I inclined my head in agreement. "Then I suppose," I said, "that we'll just have to do this old school." I drew the 18th century German dragoon pistol from the open drawer beside my left hand, aimed and fired. The ancient flintlock snapped forward, ignited the powder in the pan, and roared, a wash of unnatural blue-white fire blazing forth from the antique weapon. I almost fancied that I could see the bullet spinning and tumbling, blazing with its own tiny rune. Though Mag's shadows leapt up to defend him, he had expended enormous energy moving through the building, hurling attack after attack at us. More energy had to be used to overcome the tremendous force of the claymores that had exploded virtually in his face. Perhaps, at his full strength, at the height of his endurance, his powers would have been enough to turn even the single, potent attack that had been designed to defeat them. From the beginning, the plan had been to wear him down. The blue bolt of lead and power from the heavy old flintlock pierced Mag's defenses and body in the same instant and with the same contemptuous energy. Mag blinked at me, then lowered his head to goggle at the smoking hole in his chest
as wide as my thumb. His mouth moved as he tried to gabble something, but no sound came out. "Idiot," I said coldly. "It will be well worth the Wehrguild to be rid of you." Mag lurched toward me for a moment, intent on saying something. But the fates spared me from having to endure any more of him. He collapsed to the floor before he could finish speaking. I eyed my modern pistol, crusted with rust and residue, and decided not to try it. I kept a spare 45 in the downstairs desk in any case. I took it from another drawer, awkwardly checked it one-handed, and then emptied the weapon into Mag's head and chest. "I am the one who taught Hendrix to be thorough." I looked up from Mag's ruined form to find Justine staring at me, frozen in the middle of wrapping a bandage around my second's head. "How is he?" I asked calmly. Justine swallowed. She said, He may need stitches for the scalp wound. I think he has a concussion. The other wounds aren't bad. His armor stopped most of the fragments from going in." "Guard?" I asked without looking over my shoulder. The Valkyrie had an incredible ability to resist and recover from injury. "Be sore for a while," she said, the word slurred. "Give me a few minutes." "Justine, perhaps you will set my arm and splint it," I said. "We will need to abandon this renovation, I'm afraid, guard. Where's the thermite?" "In your upstairs office closet, right where you left it," she said in a very slightly aggrieved tone. "Be a dear and burn down the building," I said. She appeared beside my desk, looking bruised, exhausted, and functional. She lifted both eyebrows. "Was that a joke?" "Apparently," I said. "Doubtless the result of triumph and adrenaline." "My word," she said. She looked startled. "Get moving," I told her. "Make the fire look accidental. I need to contact the young lady's patron so that she can be delivered safely back into her hands. Call Dr. Schulman as well. Tell him that Mr. Hendricks and I will be visiting him shortly." I pursed my lips. "And steak, I think. I could use a good steak. The pump room should do for the three of us, eh? Ask them to stay open an extra half an hour." Guard showed me her teeth in a flash. "Well," she said, "it's no mead hall, but it will do." I put my house in order. In the end, it took less than half an hour. The troubleshooters made sure the Fomorian creatures were dragged inside, then vanished. Mag's body had been bagged and transferred to be returned to his watery kin, along with approximately $250,000 in bullion, the price required in the accords for the Wehrguild of a person of Mag's stature. Justine was ready to meet a car that was coming to pick her up, and Hendricks was already on the way to Schulman's attentions. He'd seemed fine by the time he left, growling at guard as she fussed over him. I looked around the office and nodded. "We know the defense plan has some merit," I said. "I hefted the Dragoon pistol. I'll need more of those bullets." "I was unconscious for 3 weeks after scribing the rune for that one," Guard replied. "To say nothing of the fact that the bullets themselves are rare. That one killed a man named Nelson at Trafalgar." "How do you know?" "I took it out of him," she said. "Men of his caliber are few and far between. I'll see what I can do." She glanced at Justine. "Sir?" "Not just yet," I said. "I will speak with her alone for a moment, please." She nodded, giving Justine a look that was equal parts curiosity and warning. Then she departed. I got up and walked over to the girl. She was holding the child against her again. The little girl had dropped into an exhausted sleep. "So," I said quietly, "Lara Wraith sent you to Mag's people. He happened to abduct you. You happen to escape from him, despite the fact that he seemed to be holding other prisoners perfectly adequately, and you left carrying the child. And, upon emerging from Lake Michigan, you happened to be nearby, so you came straight here." "Yes," Justine said quietly. Coincidences, coincidences, I said.
Put the child down.
Her eyes widened in alarm. I stared at her until she obeyed. My right arm was splinted and in a sling. With my left hand, I reached out and flipped open her suit jacket over her left hip, where she'd been clutching the child all evening. There was an envelope in a plastic bag protruding from the jacket's interior pocket. I took it. She made a small sound of protest and aborted it partway. I opened the bag and the envelope and scanned over the paper inside. "These are account numbers," I said quietly. "Security passwords stolen from Mag's home, I suppose." She stared at me with very wide eyes. "Dear child," I said, "I am a criminal. One very good way to cover up one crime is to commit another, more obvious one." I glanced down at the sleeping child again. "Using a child to cover your part of the scheme. Quite cold-blooded, Justine." "I freed all of Mag's prisoners to cover up the theft of his records at my lady's bidding," she said quietly. "The child was not part of the plan."
"Children frequently aren't," I said.
"I took her out on my own," she said. "She's free of that place. She will stay that way."
"To be raised among the vampires?" I asked. "Such a lovely child will surely go far."
Justine grimaced and looked away. "She was too small to swim out on her own. I couldn't leave her."
I stared at the young woman for a long moment. Then I said, "You might consider speaking to Father Fortle at St. Mary of the Angels. The church appears to have some sort of program to place those endangered by the supernatural into hiding. I do not recommend you mention my name as a reference, but perhaps he could be convinced to help the child."
She blinked at me several times. Then she said quietly, "You, sir, are not very much like I thought you were."
"Nor are you, Agent Justine."
I took a deep breath and regarded the child again.
"At least we accomplished something today." I smiled at Justine. "Your ride should be here by now. You may go."
She opened her mouth and reached for the envelope. I slipped it into my pocket. "Do give Lara my regards. And tell her that the next time she sends you out to steal honey, she should find someone else to kill the bees." I gave her a faint smile. "That will be all." Justine looked at me. Then her lips quivered up into a tiny, amused smile. She bowed her head to me, collected the child, and walked out, her steps light. I debated putting a bullet in her head, but decided against it. She had information about my defenses that could leave them vulnerable, and, more to the point, she knew that they were effective. If she should speak of today's events to Dresden... Well, the wizard would immediately recognize that the claymores, the running water, and the magic defense-piercing bullet had not been put into place to counter Mag or his odd folk at all. They were there to kill Harry Dresden. And they worked. Mag had proven that. An eventual confrontation with Dresden was inevitable. But murdering Justine would guarantee it happened immediately, and I wasn't ready for that. Not until I had rebuilt the defenses in the new location. Besides, the young woman had rules of her own. I could respect that. I would test myself against Dresden in earnest one day, or he against me. Until then, I had to gather as many resources to myself as possible. And when the day of reckoning came, I had to make sure it happened in a place where, despite his powers, he would no longer have the upper hand. Like everything else. Location, location, location.
Bigfoot on campus. This is the last of the trio of Bigfoot stories and is set between Turncoat and Changes. In this one, I got to play with the collision of a couple of different scions of supernatural beings and to get a look at how that collision would play out against the background of the world of the Dresden Files. This is also where Harry manages to insert himself into what he perceives as a parenting problem on behalf of River Shoulders, and in a quite arrogant, self-righteously wizardly fashion to boot. Naturally, his taking this position would come back to haunt him later when he would have to face similar problems and find out that the whole parenting gig is a lot harder than it looks from the outside. It was also a chance for me to revisit, if mostly in memory, the campus of the University of Oklahoma and the town of Norman, where a number of excellent and nerdy friends I made in school live to this day.
The campus police officer folded his hands and stared at me from across the table. "Coffee? What flavor is it?" I asked. He was in his 40s, a big, solid man with bags under his calm, wary eyes, and his name tag read Dean. "It's coffee-flavored coffee. No mocha? Fuck mocha. Thank God," I said. "Black." Officer Dean gave me hot black coffee in a paper cup, and I sipped at it gratefully. I was almost done shivering. It just came in intermittent bursts now. The old wool blanket Dean had given me was more gesture than cure. "Am I under arrest?" I asked him. Officer Dean moved his shoulders in what could have been a shrug. "That's what we're going to talk about." "Uh-huh," I said. "Maybe," he said in a slow rural drawl, "you could explain to me why I found you in the middle of an orgy." "Well," I said, "if you're going to be in an orgy, the middle is the best spot, isn't it?" He made a thoughtful sound. "Maybe you could explain why there was a car on the fourth floor of the dorm." "Classic college prank," I said. He grunted. "Usually when that happens, it hasn't made big holes in the exterior wall." "Someone was avoiding the cliché?" I asked. He looked at me for a moment and said, "What about all the blood?" "There were no injuries, were there?" "No," he said. "Then who cares? Some film student probably watched Carrie too many times." Officer Dean tapped his pencil's eraser on the tabletop. It was the most agitated thing I'd seen him do. "6 separate calls in the past 3 hours with a Bigfoot sighting on campus." "Bigfoot. What do you know about that?" "Well, kids these days, with their internets and their video games and their iPods, who knows what they thought they saw." Officer Dean put down his pencil. He looked at me and said calmly, "My job is to protect a bunch of kids with access to every means of self-destruction known to man from not only the criminal element, but themselves. I got chemistry students who can make their own meth, ecstasy, and LSD. I've got ROTC kids with access to automatic weapons and explosives. I got enough alcohol going through here on a weekly basis to float a battleship. I got a thriving trade in recreational drugs. I got lives to protect." "Sounds tiring." "About to get tired of you," he said. "Start giving it to me straight." "Or you'll arrest me?" I asked. "No," Dean said. "I bounce your face off my knuckles for a while. Then I ask again."
"Isn't that unprofessional conduct?"
"Fuck conduct," Dean said. "I got kids to look after." I sipped the coffee some more. Now that the shivers had begun to subside, I finally felt the knotted muscles in my belly begin to relax. I slowly settled back into my chair. Dean hadn't blustered or tried to intimidate me in any way. He wasn't trying to scare me into talking. He was just telling me how it was going to be, and he drank his coffee old school. I kind of liked the guy.
"You aren't going to believe me," I said.
"I don't much," he said. "Try me." "Okay," I said. "My name is Harry Dresden. I'm a professional wizard." Officer Dean pursed his lips. Then he leaned forward slightly and listened. The client wanted me to meet him at a site in the Ouachita Mountains in eastern Oklahoma. Looking at them, you might not realize there were mountains. They were so old.
They've had millions of years of wear and tear on them, and they've been ground down to nubs. The site used to be on an Indian reservation, but they don't call them reservations anymore. They're tribal statistical areas now. I showed my letter and my ID to a guy in a pickup who just happened to pull up next to me for a friendly chat at a lonely stop sign on a winding back road. I don't know what the tribe called his office, but I recognized a guardian when I saw one. He read the letter and waved me through in an even friendlier manner than he had used when he approached me. It's nice to be welcomed somewhere, once in a while. I parked at the spot indicated on the map and hiked a good mile and a half into the hills, taking a heavy backpack with me. I found a pleasant spot to set up camp. The mid-October weather was crisp, but I had a good sleeping bag and would be comfortable as long as it didn't start raining. I dug a fire pit and ringed it in stones, built a modest fire out of fallen limbs, and laid out my sleeping bag on a foam camp pad. By the time it got dark, I was well into preparing the dinner I'd brought with me. The scent of foil-wrapped potatoes baking in coals blended with that of the steaks I'd spitted and roasting over the fire. Can I cook a camp meal or what? Bigfoot showed up half an hour after sunset. 1 minute I was alone, the next he simply stepped into view. He was huge. Not huge like a big person, but huge like a horse, with that same sense of raw animal power and mass. He was 9 feet tall at least, and probably tipped the scales at well over 600 pounds. His powerful, wide-shouldered body was covered in long, dark brown hair. Even though he stood in plain sight in my firelight, I could barely see the buckskin bag he had slung over one shoulder and across his chest. The hair was so long. "Strength of a river in his shoulders," I said. "You're welcome at my fire." "Wizard Dresden," River Shoulders rumbled. "It is good to see you." He took a couple of long steps and hunkered down opposite the fire from me. "Man, that smells good." "Darn right it does," I said. I proceeded with the preparations in companionable silence while River Shoulders stared thoughtfully at the fire. I'd set up my camp this way for a reason. It made me the host and River Shoulders my guest. It meant I was obliged to provide food and drink, and he was obliged to behave with decorum. Guest and host relationships are damn near laws of physics in the supernatural world. They almost never get violated, and when they do, it's a big deal. Both of us felt a lot more comfortable around one another this way. Okay, maybe it did a wee bit more to make me feel comfortable than it did River Shoulders, but he was a repeat customer. I liked him, and I figured he probably didn't get treated to a decent steak all that often. We ate the meal in an almost ritualistic silence, too, other than River making some appreciative noises as he chewed. I popped open a couple of bottles of McAnally's Pale, my favorite brew by a veritable genius of hops back in Chicago. River liked it so much he gave me an inquisitive glance when his bottle was empty, so I emptied mine and produced two more. After that, I filled a pipe with expensive tobacco, lit it, took a few puffs and passed it to him. He nodded and took it. We smoked and finished our beers. By then, the fire had died down to glowing embers. "Thank you for coming," River Shoulders rumbled. "Again, I come to seek your help on behalf of my son." "Third time you've come to me," I said. "Yes." He rummaged in his pouch and produced a small, heavy object. He flicked it to me. I caught it and squinted at it in the dim light. And it was a gold nugget about as big as a ping-pong ball. I nodded and tossed it back to him. River Shoulders's brows lowered into a frown. You have to understand, a frown on a mug like his looked indistinguishable from scowling fury. It turned his eyes into shadowed caves, with nothing but a faint gleam showing from far back in them. It made his jaw muscles bunch and swell into knots the size of tennis balls on the sides of his face.
"You will not help him," the Bigfoot said. I snorted.
"You're the one who isn't helping him, big guy."
"I am," he said. "I am hiring you."
"You're his father.
I said quietly. And he doesn't even know your name. He's a good kid. He deserves more than that. He deserves the truth. He shook his head.